You're listening to Greater LA on KCRW, the show that connects you to the people and places of Southern California. Hey there, I'm Steve Chiotakis. Today, we're peeking through the revolving door in politics. You've probably heard that phrase. When legislators finish their terms in office, they frequently start lobbying for companies or groups to influence votes in Congress. Well, lobbyists work for all kinds of causes, the petroleum industry or abortion rights or big pharma or environmental groups. And sometimes they lobby to get Congress to help out another nation. Now, no one thinks twice when it's a U.S. ally. But what about when it's a country that, let's say, doesn't share our democratic values? Well, that happens, too. And it turns out some lobbyists for authoritarian countries once represented you, the voters of Southern California. There are public records out there showing how some of our former Congress members now earn their paychecks. And KCRW's Kaylee Wells decided to do a little digging, and she joins me right now. Hey, Kaylee.
Hey, Steve.
The Russian invasion of Ukraine has prompted a few stories about lobbyists for Russia or Russian business interests suddenly becoming very unpopular, right, in Washington. But we typically don't pay attention to the causes our former elected officials get paid to promote. Why is that?
Well, that's a great place to start. I actually put that question to Ben Freeman from a nonprofit called Quincy Institute for Responsible Statecraft. And he thinks it's been kept hush-hush on purpose because it'd be bad for their business.
I think the public doesn't know about this by design. It's very much in these lobbyists' interests for the public to not know that they are lobbyists. And especially not know that they are former members of Congress, are former high-ranking congressional staffers who are now lobbying on behalf of dictators.
We also didn't know as much about it because he says the public just didn't used to care as much. But that did change a few years ago.
It just was not a topic that was front of mind for folks. People didn't see it as a concern. The 2016 election really proved to people what could happen because of foreign interference, because of foreign meddling in U.S. politics.
Okay, so Freeman just used the word dictator there, Kaylee. That's a strong word. Which countries are these people representing?
You're right. So the word dictator does sound kind of inflammatory, but it really just means a government where a single person or a single party has absolute power. And that does describe some of the nations that our former California-based politicians work for. So that includes some more authoritarian nations such as Egypt, the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia, and the Democratic Republic of Congo.
So then who are these California-based foreign lobbyists?
Okay, so let's start with Ed Royce.
Oh, okay. Ed Royce used to represent a bunch of South L.A., right? South L.A. over to, like, into Bellflower, places like that.
Yeah, he did. He was the U.S. rep for 26 years until 2019 there. And then he also represented the district east of that, which included Fullerton all the way to Walnut.
Well, then who's he representing, a.k.a. lobbying for now?
So anytime lobbyists get foreign compensation, they have to report it. And those public documents show that in July of last year, Royce started working for one of the most powerful leaders in the Democratic Republic of Congo, Moise Katumbi. For about $20,000 a month, his job was to represent Katumbi to the U.S. on issues related to free and fair elections. So that included arranging meetings with political leaders in Congress and the Biden administration with the goal of strengthening cooperation between the two countries. That might not sound bad, but there's reason to be skeptical of that country's free and fair elections. The current president's election was controversial. The press criticizes the government there, and some of them report threats of violence and arrest. There's kind of a different concern with another ex-congressman from Southern California, Buck McKeon. Do you remember him?
Another local congressman, right?
Yeah, until about 2015. He represented basically the northern third of L.A. County and a little bit of Ventura County from Simi Valley all the way to Lancaster and even east of that.
And what's his job now?
Well, when that term ended, his next job was to work with members of Congress regarding the priorities and interests of Saudi Arabia. Since he started representing them in 2016, his lobbying firm has made more than $2 million from the Saudi government. Freeman described McKeon's resume to me as, quote, everything that's wrong with the system.
When he was in Congress, he was the chairman of the Armed Services Committee, the House Armed Services Committee. which helps to set the U.S. defense budget. Within the U.S. defense budget includes weaponry, military training that comes from major defense contractors and goes to countries like Saudi Arabia. When Buck McKeon leaves office, he leaves that very position. He starts a lobbying firm, and as soon as he possibly can, he then turns around and represent those exact same defense companies and the government of Saudi Arabia, too.
Freeman says he then lobbied his former colleagues for weapon sales from the weapons manufacturer he represents to Saudi Arabia, who he also represents. So case in point of the revolving door. By the way, I did reach out to McKeon and to Ed Royce for comment more than once, but they did not respond.
Is this all legal, Kaylee? I mean, you're not telling me he's breaking the law, are you?
No, it's legal. There is a cool-off period that varies by state after a lawmaker leaves Congress before they can lobby after that. And it might feel ethically icky to know they're using insider knowledge and relationships of the U.S. government for the benefits of countries that actively work against democracy, but no, it's legal. So, for instance, Nadeem Elshami, who spent 25 years working in Congress, who we actually might know better as Speaker Nancy Pelosi's former chief of staff, he lobbied for Egypt last year, and his filing said he provided strategic counsel, managed perception for them, and helped with economic development. Elshami also, by the way, did not agree to talk about that work with KCRW.
What do you think he's really doing, though? I mean, that sounds really vague, right?
You're right. Those jobs do sound vague, and they are. I actually said the same thing to Raad Jarar. He's the director for a group called Democracy for the Arab World Now.
They are vaguely worded because they can. In real life, it's not vague at all.
Jarar says the public records aren't supposed to give you specifics, but he did give me some examples of what that might mean.
We have seen these lobbyists, for example, on behalf of the Egyptian government, meet with congressional staffers who are responsible for allocating U.S. tax dollars for foreign military financing, for U.S. aid to Egypt, to ensure that that billions of U.S. dollars continue to flow to the Egyptian government, despite very strong opposition from human rights groups here in the U.S., despite very strong opposition from lawmakers in the U.S.
So this vague wording ensures that it's kind of hard for people like me to understand exactly what's going on.
Yeah. And he said strong opposition from lawmakers right here in the U.S. I mean, why is there not bipartisan support to stop stuff like this?
Well, he says people aren't exactly keen to vote against their future selves because about half of Congress members become lobbyists when their terms expire.
Many members of Congress think they will become lobbyists after they retire. So privately, when I meet with congressional staffers or with members of Congress, they agree that this is corrupt. But members of Congress will not come out publicly criticizing their former colleagues and their future selves, because many of them think that they will get a fancy job at a lobbying firm that pays 10 or 20 times more what they're getting paid now as a member of Congress.
Well, this isn't one of those stories, Kaylee, that leaves us feeling great at the end, is it?
No, I can't say it is yet. I mean, not until we see Congress actually do something about this revolving door.
KCRW's Kaylee Wells reporting for us. Kaylee, thank you.
Thanks, Steve.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
Onward now with Greater LA on KCRW. I'm Steve Chiotakis. From pho to hot chicken to mouthwatering classic Chinese dishes, Chinatown is a mecca of great food, a place where you're able to check out Howlin' Rays or Hop Woo Barbecue and Seafood for finger-licking food. But the folks who live in Chinatown, well, they have a harder time getting access to all the things they need to make all that food at home. That's because for the past couple of years, Chinatown has not had a major supermarket. There's some small shops and bodegas for sure, but if you live in the neighborhood and you want a big selection of affordable items, you're going to have to go somewhere else. And that can be a challenge for many local households. Andrea Chang reported on this for the LA Times, and she's here to tell us all about it. Hey, Andrea.
Hey, Steve. How are you?
I'm all right. There was a major supermarket in Chinatown. And by the way, food deserts are everywhere, right? There are places that just don't have grocery stores for economic reasons, things like that, right? So Chinatown not having one, I mean, it did and now it doesn't. What's going on there?
Chinatown has had so many different supermarkets through the years. Lots of large supermarkets, usually Asian-focused. So the biggest one that closed 2 years ago was called Ai Hua. It was a Vietnamese market and kind of like a central hub for a lot of people who have lived in Chinatown for many decades, particularly elderly, low-income residents. But unfortunately, it closed towards the end of 2019, and ever since then, there has been no full-service grocery store in Chinatown, which strikes a lot of people as kind of strange given how that neighborhood has become such a trendy hotspot for restaurants.
What does a major grocery store, Andrea, offer residents that maybe a bodega or some small shop doesn't or can't?
So a major, what we call a full service grocery store, is one that's open 7 days a week, opens early, closes late, and has a very vast selection of produce, poultry, other meats, household items, and also affordable prices. Whereas, you know, you do have a lot of mini marts left in Chinatown, especially those now being run by businesses that used to be something else, like a bookstore now sells produce, a sandwich shop now sells produce. But the problem there is, you know, you might go in looking for a certain kind of fruit and find that your options that day are just bananas and apples. Or maybe you want like a specialty cut of beef to make pho, and instead you can get chicken and some fish, but that's about it.
What have locals said about this? What are people in the neighborhood saying about this? Are they really affected by this? Or are they like, all right, well, now I just have to hop on the 110? Or maybe some people don't have a way to get there, right?
Right. Chinatown is a community that has a really aging population, and many of them are low income or in fixed incomes. So, for instance, the median household income in Chinatown is $36,000. That's less than half of like the countywide figure. It's almost 50%. It's about 50% Asian. And a lot of those people don't drive. So if you don't have a central grocery store in the middle of your neighborhood, you're really lacking options. A lot of the people that we spoke with take the bus by themselves. These were women and men in their 70s or older, and they would take the bus as far as San Gabriel Valley to be able to go to a grocery store to get the ingredients that they needed. And they were saying, you know, it takes a long time, it's not really safe, and it would just be a lot better if there was one just down the block the way Ai Hua used to be.
The fascinating thing about this is you do go to Chinatown because there are some great restaurants there, a lot of trendy places, as I mentioned, but this is, you know, and you also say that it's not a wealthy neighborhood, but it is central. It is another LA neighborhood that's expected to gentrify in the coming years, right? A lot of people go there, and it does seem like that maybe the rents aren't quite as expensive as in other parts of town.
Right. Chinatown currently is in this in-between stage. It is fast gentrifying, which means there's a lot of sort of uneasy tensions that are arising in that neighborhood. There are hundreds of new apartment units that are expected to come online in the next few years. That's going to bring an influx of new residents into that community. And they are expected to be younger, wealthier. And the commercial real estate brokers that I spoke with for this story mentioned that when that happens, retailers are going to be a little bit more motivated to bring a grocery store back to Chinatown. But on the opposite end, you know, for the residents who have been there for four decades, they don't feel great about, you know, seeing their neighborhood continue to change in that way. So there's a lot of community groups that are like, we need to not only look after our older residents, but also preserve the historic identity of Chinatown and protect the businesses that have been here for a really long time.
In your article, Andrea, you write that there are vendors in Chinatown who set up on the sidewalk, right, and sell produce. Because this is about fresh produce, too. This is, you know, these big box stores or the supermarkets are able to get that fresh produce into the area. But they do that, these vendors do that at inflated prices. What are some of the items being sold and what's the markup?
So street vending has become a huge problem in Chinatown. There have, you know, vendors have always been there on the corners, but ever since street vending became legal in LA recently, now you're seeing it's on another level. So if you walk down Broadway in Chinatown on any given day now, there's dozens and dozens of street vendors. Most of them are unlicensed. They're breaking the rules, you know, setting up right outside storefronts with their blankets, putting stuff on the floor. Stuff isn't refrigerated. It's extending several feet into the sidewalk. So sometimes you actually have to walk into the street to avoid the produce setups on the floor, which is upsetting residents and business owners. The markups can be very steep. So I spoke with a woman who lives in Chinatown, and she said she was passing by one day and saw mangoes going for $7 each, which is, you know, as she mentioned, outrageous. We talked to another elderly man who lives in Chinatown, and he said he just had to give up. You know, and sometimes if his son doesn't have time to drop off groceries with him, he ends up having to spend like $20 on drooping vegetables for a hot pot.
What do you think is going to happen to that Aihua site? What the developer says is going to happen?
Yeah, so one of the frustrating parts when we were reporting the story is that the developer that bought that property, actually back in 2018 is when he purchased it for more than $15 million. It was the Aihua building and nearby storefronts as well. At the time, the property developer is named Gilmore, and they said that they would open a new market in the space. But when we drove by it, I mean, it looks completely untouched. The Aihua lettering is still out front, faded. Everything's boarded up. And we called and emailed multiple times and didn't hear back from them. So it's unclear what's going to happen in that space.
Is this a market thing? A market is in, you know, the marketplace, whether or not, you know, a Ralph's or a Vons or a place like that goes into a, you know, a big storefront like the Aihua was, or perhaps another place. I mean, how come they haven't entered the Chinatown area?
It is absolutely a market economy issue. Simply put, you know, the commercial real estate broker said the problem is even though Chinatown is changing right now, it hasn't changed enough yet to entice a supermarket to come in. So the comparisons that we heard when talking to brokers were, you know, if you are a supermarket chain, you look at, you know, the whole of downtown and surrounding neighborhoods. And right now it's the neighborhoods like the Arts District, South Park, Little Tokyo, and Bunker Hill that are, you know, the hotspots for retailers. They have large, dense populations of young residents who like to spend money and stay out. They look at Chinatown and they see it as a place where people are visiting, you know, on the weekends and at night to come eat. But then once the sun goes down, they are no longer in Chinatown. And then what's left is low-income residents. And a supermarket sees that and says, you know, we'd actually rather open up somewhere else.
Andrea Chang, reporter for the LA Times. Andrea, thanks for coming on and talking to us about it. I appreciate it.
Thanks, Steve, for having me. I appreciate it, too.
Straight ahead, it's not term limits, it's ending the term of Orange County Assemblyman Tom Daley. Gustavo Arellano chimes in from behind the orange curtain. Onward now with Greater LA on KCRW. Steve Chiotakis here. After five terms at the State House, the Assemblyman for Anaheim and Santa Ana is calling it quits. Let's head down to OC. Tom Daley represents the heavily blue 68th District. He says he's going to keep pushing for practical results for his constituents through the end of his term in November. But why is he leaving now? Gustavo Arellano is columnist for the LA Times. Every week he joins us for KCRW's Orange County Line. Hey, Gustavo.
Hola, Steve.
Tell us a little bit about Tom Daley.
Oh, yeah. Tom Daley's like Anaheim through and through. Born in the city, went to my alma mater, Anaheim High School, and he's been in an elected position since 1986. I think it's the second longest tenure currently in Orange County after Jerry Patterson, who's on the Coast Community College District, who used to be a congressman back in the day. But Daley's done it all politically. He started off as a school board member, went to the city council in Anaheim, was a mayor for a long time, then became Orange County's clerk recorder for about a decade. And then for the past decade, past, you know, five terms, he has been the assembly member for Anaheim, but also Santana, and then until this redistricting, Garden Grove.
So he's in his fifth term now. Has he accomplished anything like significant in his time in Sacramento, something that he can point to?
When he started, he did something extraordinary, of course. He was a Democrat from Orange County in Sacramento. And that was victory enough at a time where Orange County, you know, he has seen the evolution of Orange County from the place where, you know, Reagan said all the good Republicans go to die, to now Democrats increasingly being the majority of the congressional delegation for Orange County, and including more and more. But he did it in his way, which is to be a moderate. So he'll say his biggest accomplishment was being a fiscal, you know, being a fiscal conservative, socially liberal, really pushing California to have a rainy day fund in case we do have budgetary fiascos, which, of course, in California has always been a boom or a bust.
It's always extreme in one way or the other. There are term limits, Gustavo, for folks serving in the state legislature, though. Daley's in his fifth term, as I mentioned. How many more would he have been able to serve?
Yeah, you're always changing term limits in California, how much you can serve or whatnot. And last I remember, it's like you could only serve 12 straight years in either chamber of the California legislature. So he's been for 10 years, so five terms. So he could have ran one final time, then at six, and then off into the sunset. But I think he saw with the redistricting, seeing where the winds are blowing in Orange County, he wanted to step down right now, go up on top, and then hopefully have someone continue in his path.
Well, talk about the redistricting. He saw the writing on the wall. I mean, was he facing a tougher race in November? Is that why he decided to go?
All the Democrats right now are facing tougher races wherever you go, especially in Orange County. You have a younger generation, the Burners, running for council, running, and in Santana, which Daley represents, people who supported Bernie Sanders in 2020. And Daley was facing, if not a real opponent, definitely someone who's going to call him out all the time, and a guy named Bulmaro Vicente, who goes by Boomer Vicente, and he definitely represents the Bernie wing. So I think Daley saw that. Now, like, my kind of moderate Democrat, it's not really what Orange County wants anymore. But right now, while I have the opportunity, I'm going to step down. And lo and behold, the day he announced that he's not going to run anymore, his chief of staff, Avelino Valencia, said, I'm running.
So his chief of staff runs. The people, a couple of folks to the left of him, are running for that seat as well. Who do you see as the front runner in this race for the 68th?
So you remember it's going to be a primary in June. So they're going to be the two. There is a Republican opponent, but no one cares. So it's going to be between the two Democrats, Bulmaro Vicente, the progressive wing, and Avelino Valencia, who's more to the left of Daley. But come on, you're a chief of staff for Daley, so you're going to be somewhat moderate. Another Anaheim boy, born and raised, went to our rival high school, Cotella High School. I don't hold it against them. But he's already the favorite. He's already gotten the endorsements of a lot of the Democrat political class, including a speaker, California Assembly Speaker of Anthony Rendon, and all of that. So he's a presumptive favorite, but we'll see. It's going to be a really interesting referendum on the most Democratic area of Orange County. Is it going more left? I mean, we know it's blue, but is it going to be more left, or is it still going to be the moderate road that Tom Daley and the state senator, Tom Umberg, and the congressman, Lou Correa, that they have created over the past generation?
Gustavo Arellano, columnist for the LA Times, here with KCRW's Orange County Line. Gustavo, thanks.
Gracias.
That's going to do it for us today. Tomorrow, the harrowing story of an LA man born in Ukraine but came to the United States as a child who could soon be fighting on behalf of Ukraine. Not only that, but with his 71-year-old father. We'll talk about that tomorrow on another episode of Greater LA. Join us online anytime at kcrw.com/GLA. There you can subscribe to the podcast or get the podcast wherever you get your podcasts. You can also tell us how you're doing, tell us how we're doing as well, all at the website, kcrw.com/GreaterLA. Jenna Cagle, Nihar Patel, Andrea Bautista, Sonia Geis, Ray Guarna, Phil Richards, Amy Ta, Mike Vogel, and Christian Bordahl all put hard work into tonight's episode. I'm Steve Chiotakis. Thanks for the ear and the time. Have a great night.